we honor Treaty Day, which is a commemoration of and a commitment to promises made on January 22, 1855, when 85 chiefs and leaders representing many Coast Salish nations signed the Treaty of Point Elliot. Last week, Freddie Lane and a group of North Lakers gathered to read through the Point Elliot Treaty. A recording of it is available, and we encourage everyone to listen as part of our ongoing commitment to learning. Chief Seattle's name is at the top of that treaty, so our call to worship this morning is an excerpt from a speech he gave before the treaty was signed. His words are a powerful reminder that none of us is separate or siloed, because we all are intricately woven together in an interdependent web of all living things. These are his words. Should we accept your proposition, I here and now make this the first condition that we will not be denied the privilege without molestation of visiting at will the graves where we have buried our ancestors and our friends and our children. Every part of this country is sacred to my people. Every hillside, every valley, every plain and grove has been hallowed by some fond memory or sad experience of my tribe. Even the rocks, which seem to lie dumb as they shelter in the sun along the silent seashore, in solemn grandeur, thrill with memories of past events connected to the lives of my people. When your children's children shall think of themselves alone in the fields, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of the pathless woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth, there is no place dedicated to solitude.
I made a list of things I want to say, but I don't usually follow this stuff. I'm not very good at it, because we come from an oral people where you're supposed to talk from the heart, not from a list. And there's a certain belief amongst our people that when you take your first breath in life, that's a sacred breath. And your last breath is a sacred breath. And your measurement of life is what you did with every breath in between those two. I want to talk a little bit about how the fiction came to be, how the lie came to be true. And this is a Christian nation, and you're supposed to be respectful, humble, and honest. And you should hold each other accountable to that principle. And that's what we hope society is all about. You know, and, as Native Americans, especially the Coast Salish, we go, oh, see, we raise our hands to you because you're operating in a respectful way, a high-class way. Well, there's an old legend or myth, if you may, that preceded discovery. Throughout North, Middle, and South America, a teacher came. And wherever that teacher went, it was from village to village and nation to nation, and taught about peace and love. And they say wherever that teacher went, you could tell that he had an impact because the people would go like this or like this. And so where did the teachings come from? How long have this teacher that we're in search of? You know, they're avatars, we call them by many names, but prominent people come into our life and we hold them with the belief that they're being honest. You know, when we were discovered, the church said in the discovery doctrine that in order to prevent war between Christian nations, that if one Christian nation found a territory first, that Christian nation had first rights. Well, what did they have the right to? It was unoccupied. They call it terra nullius in Australia, terra nullius. If it's unoccupied, then you had the rights to claim it. But if it's occupied, you had the right to form first relationships with the people. And so after about 300 years, it finally gets into the United States Supreme Court, and U.S. Chief Justice Marshall has the opportunity to rule on what does the discovery doctrine mean, because King George, under the proclamation of King George, told everybody in 1763, stay out of Indian country. It's a sovereign relationship. If I choose as the king to go in there as a sovereign, I will do that. But you, the people, stay out of there until you get my blessings. And so that was the proclamation of King George. And then we get into the U.S. Constitution, where the founding fathers are saying, we're going to structure the relationships with the Indian tribes. So something like Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution says, excluding Indians not taxed. Well, why were we not taxed? Because we're not one of you. We're not a part, we're excluded from we, the people of the United States. We had our own nations, we had our own people, we had our own government and our language and our spiritual practices. We were separate from the United States. So if the United States wanted to enter relationships with us, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. It doesn't say of the Indian tribes, but over time it became to regulate the whole life of all Indians. And so that's a long stretch to try to reach into Indian country and take over control. But this is 1787, the Constitution is ratified, it's a part of it. If the United States wants to form relationships with us, then Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, the president can negotiate treaties authorized by Congress, and the Senate can ratify those treaties. 700 treaties negotiated, 360 ratified. But the United States took the benefit of all 700 treaties. And so under international law, that's ratification by action. And so every one of those, quote, unratified treaties are binding upon the United States, whatever they promised those Indian tribes who are now unrecognized or maybe extinct, was a binding relationship. Article 3, Section 2, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution gave the United States Supreme Court authority to review questions of national law, constitutional law, or treaties made. Article 6, Clause 1 and Clause 2 holds that prior treaties negotiated and treaties made are supreme law of the land. And so the United States was looking at the whole domain, and so they had what they called big states versus little states. The big states had endowments from the king that said they owned everything to the South Seas. Well, when you're going across the Panama Isthmus, you know, it's 300 miles across. Okay, it's not really long, wide. But so the king didn't know it was 3,000 miles wide. And so people, states like New York had a major land claim. And in the negotiations of 1787, they said, okay, the big states, we release our large land claims, provided new states can be admitted into the Union. And so in order to regulate that, they passed the Northwest Ordinance. And in the Northwest Ordinance, it says they're going to honor and respect the rights and ownership of the Indians. And so that would be treaties made. That would be the process. And so a new territory could come into existence if, and they become a state, if they acknowledge they have no jurisdiction over Indians and Indian rights and lands. because that's a national relationship. And so Washington State has Article 26, still to this day, Article 26 that says they have no jurisdiction inside the lands of the Indians or the rights of the Indian people. And so that became a binding obligation when the state of Washington joined the Union in 1889, but it was a part of a precedent that was set across the whole United States. The Point Elliott Treaty is modeled on a treaty with the Omahas. Commissioner George Moneypenny says, well, this is the one I negotiated, take it, Isaac Stevens, and Joel Palmer of Oregon Territory, Isaac Stevens of Washington Territory, and you negotiate those treaties, because the United States was in conflict with Russia, Spain, and England over the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, and so they wanted to make have those countries back out, saying, because those countries were saying, we discovered it, we were here first, we have superior right, you want to go to war, we'll go to war. And so the United States is like, well, fledgling the United States, let's negotiate it. And so they negotiate agreements with Spain and England and Russia separately. They withdraw, and the Pacific Northwest becomes United States territory, or a claim, they have a claim to it. And then the Congress authorizes treaties to be negotiated. Now, the Treaty of Port Elliott is a part of a boilerplate treaty. Joel Palmer of Oregon Territory and Isaac Stevens negotiated some treaties together, but Isaac Stevens negotiated the Treaty of Port Elliott, and it was in the negotiations. We had different languages, okay? We didn't speak English. We didn't speak Russian or Spanish. You know, and so there's a problem here. And so the people like George Gibbs came in, and they spoke Chinook jargon. Ishlash, Suikla, Apanamiku, who is called Skurum Utstreedy? So she'll interpret it. Well, yeah, she doesn't know what I said, but she's supposed to tell those other tribes what I said. She's the interpreter. You know, and so, you know, it's the old game where you whisper in one child's ear, and by the time it goes through the whole class, the story is different. And so that's why the United States Supreme Court make rules that the treaties are to be understood as the Indians understood them. Now, in the Johnson v. McIntosh case of 1823, when Supreme Court Justice Marshall had to look at the application of the discovery doctrine, something was going on behind the scenes. His dad and himself had applied for 258,000 acres inside Indian country, inside the Ohio Territory. And how he makes the ruling is going to determine whether or not they're going to secure title. And so what he did is, as we said, is it empty, terra nullius, or is it occupied? It's not a hard question. There's somebody there. It must be occupied. And so, you know, that's pretty clear. Then you have a relationship right. But instead, what he did is he kind of twisted it so that the United States now owned the territory as if it was unoccupied. Okay, that's Johnson v. McIntosh. It's not the discovery doctrine. It's Johnson v. McIntosh that went all across the United States, up into Canada, down in South America, Middle America, over into Australia, even in the southern reaches of South Africa. It just spread across. It gave a claim. Even though occupied, we claim it. You know, and so you are temporary occupants. And so in cases like Cherokee versus Georgia, you know, the Supreme Court had to look at whether or not the state of Georgia had rights to be inside the Indian territory. And based on the Constitution and treaties made, the court says, no, you cannot be inside the boundaries of the Cherokee Nation. And so, you know, Andrew Jackson says, well, the Supreme Court made their decision, let them enforce it. You know, and they began the trail of tears. Let's get rid of the Indians then. Is that so? Getting rid of the Indians has always been a major policy issue. It comes in, it goes out, it comes in, it goes out. Here in the Pacific Northwest, Chief Seattle was 9 years old when Vancouver sailed into the Straits of Juan de Fuca in 1792. My Indian name is Sasiath. I am from the Snoqualmie, the Duwamish, the Tlalum, the Skagit, the Lummi, the Saanich, the Nooksack tribes. And I'm only three-quarters blood, so I don't know where, how many more is involved in that other side. The other quarter is Dutch. So I think I'll go back and claim Holland. There's nobody there. It's not occupied. I don't see any real people. You know, so I don't think there's a problem. But the thing about Chief Seattle is he said that one time we numbered more than the stars in the sky. That time is no more. What happened was that smallpox, Euro-American diseases came in. We were virgin soil. We had no such thing. We had spiritual illness. We had social illness. But we didn't have these physical illnesses. And it killed 80 to 90% of the villages. The hunters went off to hunt for a couple of weeks, came back, everybody in the village is dead. The whalers went out whaling, they came back, everybody was dead. Except for the baby suckling on the deceased mother. Time and time again, when they first came into the Puget Sound, the Walsh, the explorer said, "Whoa, there's a whole Indian village unoccupied." Well, in some of them, there are skulls and bones laying all over. The people fled. When smallpox hit Victoria in the 1860s, they sent them out. They say, immunized them. They could have immunized them all, but that didn't happen. They sent them out, and smallpox came all the way up along the east coast, Vancouver Island, over into the mainland, and hit the Semiama. And my mom would cry all the time. They killed my mom's people. They sent smallpox to us. Her grandmother fled from the village, one of the little children fleeing. Everybody around her is dying. And she fled up into Catesy and was raised at Catesy for the next 8 years. Then she came back and she had an arranged marriage. In our way, you trace family bilateral, and you have advice. You come from somebody. You come from a status people. You had teachings. You knew how to be honorable and respectful and humble. And the key thing was to be generous. We were what some have called a potlatch society. If you go out and you go into nature, well, in our belief system, everything had spirit. Everything had a song. And if you went out there and you bathed and you fasted and you suffered and you cried and become a humble human being, that spirit of that tree might have pity on you, or that animal, or even that insect, or that rock. Everything had spirit. It's like going into the Garden of Eden. God created everything. Everything is created by God. Everything was created by the Word. Everything has rhythm. Everything has beauty. Everything has relationship. Everything has pity on you, the poor little human beings. And so you come to us, and we'll give you a power, and you become wealthy. And with that wealth, everybody sees you. You pile up a whole lot of wealth. And then what happens? It's not for you. It's for everybody. So they distribute it. The more you give away, the more of a status, humble, honorable person you were. So you compile wealth to share it with all the people and distribute it. And so these people were Siams. They were reef net people. They were head captains of the reef nets. My great-great-grandfather on my mom's side was a reef net owner. My great-great-grandma on my dad's side was a reef net owner. They had their own longhouse, their own plank house, and they had their own potlatches, and they had to build the wealth up and give it away. My great-great-grandfather on my dad's side, he had six wives. My great-great-grandfather on my mother's side had 10 wives. Well, this was a relationship, really like a corporation. We own everything for all of the extended family, and we'll make a decision as to how best to distribute. And we'll give you permission to access our world, access our resources, if you don't do any harm, if you don't come as an enemy, if you come in peace and you respect like we do. Because up there, we have everything's haha, everything's sacred. Everything has sacred being, so you can't go in and destroy it. So there are 14 reef net captains at the treaty negotiations. And when you stood up, they said, they look at you and they say, "You got breath. You got a sacred breath. Your words must be true." And you call on witnesses just like we did, because our witnesses are there to say what that person said was true. And he or she lived up to what they said they will do. And so that's what the witness was for. It wasn't a written word. You could write a word down, walk away, and forget it. Just like I forgot I had a list. And so you could forget it, but it's because it's not coming from the heart. You take it and you put it outside of you, just that like you put God outside of you. If God's not in you, where's God at? You know, what are you searching for then? You know, we know you have the concept of crystals. Crystals is that seed. It's that little seed inside. One day you have a vision, an experience, and boom, it blossoms. And I believe in God. I believe in the power. I've seen it take place. Nobody can say anything that'll convince me this is not true. Life is sacred. Everything around me is sacred. Everything has power. Everything's related. I believe it. I've seen it. And so nobody can tell you it's not true. It doesn't matter. I experienced it. It bloomed. That's crystals. And you celebrate the myth of Adam. You know, you weren't there. For all you know, it wasn't true. You know, we have Swatan. Swatan was first man. Swatan came from the sky. Swatan was endowed with power. Swatan needed somebody. We am. You call Adam. You call Eve. We say Swatan. We am. Why is ours a myth and yours is reality? You know, we're obligated by the sacred breath to only tell the truth. And it's been handed down from generation after generation. This is the truth. God gave you a gift. You say, Adam, Adam's from Adamus. Red earth. We wear red earth. And there was a young girl dug up over in Eastern Washington. She was buried 14,000 years ago, and she was painted with red earth. And we still, when we sing and we dance and we celebrate on Treaty Day, we'll put on our red earth, because it's a sign that we're connected to the earth. You know, so who are the witnesses? The mountains are witness. The rivers are witness. The tides are witness. And so this is what Stephen said. We call upon the witnesses. And so we call upon the witnesses to hold everything to be true. I think of Roosevelt. I want what all Americans want. A United States Supreme Court that shall adhere to the canons and constructions of written constitutions and not amendment by judicial say-so. I wrote a 48-page paper to Clinton when he was president, and he said, if that's not the law, it should be, and we'll fall in compliance with that paper. But he got impeached. And so the thing is that there was a solicitor of the Department of Interior, Felix Cohen. Like the miner's canary, the American Indian marks a shift from fresh air to poison gas in our political atmosphere. Our treatment of the Indian, even more than our treatment of other minorities, marks the rise and fall in our democratic faith. We are a people that believe in the sovereignty of the people. In the beginning, under the Articles of Confederation, you thought, we're going to be a state, and the state is sovereign. The state pre-exists the people. That's not true. Without people, the state couldn't come into being. And so almost went to revolution again, so they rewrote the Constitution into a popular sovereignty constitution. We the people of the United States, we the people of the state of Washington. Article 4 of the Constitution says that new territories can become new states if they follow a Republican form of government. A government based on the will of the people. We are the ones that hold government accountable. Treaties are only a supreme law of the land if the people believe it. Otherwise, the court's willing to create a legal fiction. Oh, you want to take it? Well, the Lummi Reservation was for us only. We kept it. You didn't give it to us. We already owned it. We gave you this, everything outside of this. That's what we ceded. We never gave up anything. We didn't give up our religion. We didn't give up our grave sites. We didn't give up our sacred sites. We didn't give up our concept of the spiritual or sacred time. None of that was negotiated in the treaties. The treaty is a grant of rights from the Indian tribes to the United States, U.S. versus Women's, 1905. And it's still binding that way. Now, somebody asked me, do you support the Duwamish tribe? Well, my grandfather, great-grandfather was Peter James, and he was Snoqualmie Duwamish. He married into Lummi, and he fought for the Duwamish, the Snoqualmie, and other tribes to exist. He would walk every place and made it to D.C., but he helped organize the tribes. And my grandfather, the late grandfather, was also on Duwamish Council. And my uncle from Swinomish, my uncle from Lummi, and two relatives from Muckleshoot. Muckleshoot is the Duwamish tribe. Muckleshoot are named after Muckleshoot Prairie. And my great-grandfather's brother, Brother Anthony James, is enrolled Muckleshoot. He's on number 51 on the rolls of the Muckleshoot tribe, the Duwamish tribe. And so on the Duwamish people, I was there when this new Duwamish called for their existence. They marched on Willard Beale, who was an associate professor at UW. And I told them then, there's 1,158 of us on the rolls. Half-blood, full-blood, quarter-blood, what have you. And we're all Duwamish. And you got to see us. We're your relatives. Instead, they wiped us all out and started the fresh bunch. And so they think of me as the enemy, because I said, no, we got to stop your recognition until you recognize your own people. And so, well, that's who I was all the way from the 70s on. I battled them to try to get them to recognize who the Duwamish were as a people. And we're still waiting. There's a reason why my grandfather was on the Duwamish Council. There was a reason why my great-grandfather was on the Duwamish Council. And it's not the same council, okay? That one came into existence after USB Washington. And so if you want to hear some more happier news about them, then you have to ask somebody else, okay? All right, thank you. I guess my time's up. Fred keeps giving me the sign. So do I ask, answer questions or just get down? Are we done? Okay. Or is there any questions? In your opinion, what would adequate reparations for Indians look like? Well, that's part of the problem, is that, back in the 80s, I was fighting for to stop the United States government trying to tax fishing rights, and I was really dismayed over the history of the churches. The churches came in and, trust us, come to me, I am your father, I'll protect you. And so in that process, we got stripped of all spirituality. And we're told that we're heathens, pagans, atheists, agnostics. We got all the name calling, and we looked for honest support. And I told the Lummi Nation, you can't trust the churches. I don't want to work with churches. Our history of experience is that they've been oppressive. That's why, the churches took over Indian country in 1872 under President Grant. And they said, Grant was so upset because they had to move Indian affairs from the Department of War to the Department of Interior because the Department of War kept stealing all the appropriations for Indian country. And none of those treaty appropriations were going out to the Indian people. So they're going back to war. And so they said, so let's transfer it to the Department of Interior, make it an interior matter. So the Department of Interior got it. And so the Department of Interior, guess what they did? Stole everything. And so President Grant, President Grant says, is there anybody honest enough to run Indian affairs? Oh, I know the churches. And so the first thing the churches did was enact the American Indian Religious Crimes Code. And so we couldn't sing, we couldn't dance, we couldn't worship, we couldn't do anything ceremonial, ritualistically. And so we couldn't believe in our old way anymore. And so we had to convert and become farmers. And that was the goal, that was the effort. And it devastated us. We already suffered from a lot of knowledge keepers, indigenous ways of knowing, traditional ways of knowing. Those people died off, and we're trying to regroup, we're trying to recover, and now you want to negotiate treaties, now you turn us over to the churches. And so, you know, in 1987, the churches, 10 bishops from 9 denominations signed the Apology of Churches that was issued in my name, and it was renewed in 1997 and 2007, but I guess everybody got tired of it because it wasn't renewed in 2017, you know, and we're asking you to hear us. Hear us, hear us. You know, somebody says, oh, that Joel James, he has a real foul mouth. That's what Freddie says. Well, you know, sooner or later, after you're hurt so often, you might stand up and scream and cuss too, you know. I used to give speeches about history of oppression and how it impacted our people. And my mother went with me a couple times. At the end of each lecture at the universities, she'd be just sobbing, just crying her heart out. Now, I'd have to wait for her to get done. I said, Mom, what is wrong? I didn't know I had it so bad. You know, then next time she went with me, she was sitting with an elderly Hawaiian woman, and they're both over there sobbing. We didn't know we had it so bad. You know, because you grow up with the pain. You grow up in the trauma. You grow up in the abuse. And you learn to adjust and adapt. You don't fully accept it. You try to get it out of your head, out of your heart, out of your mind. And so that, it's been a traumatic historical relationship for Indian country. Oh, look, our sacred words on this treaty. Come here. Well, everything you promised, you violated. It's hard for us as at home. Most Lummies will say it's a day of mourning. It's a time to be sad. We trusted them. You know, and people, we used to have an elder named Joe Washington. He'd go, they took everything I had. I had inherited 5 estates. They gave me $5 3 months in a row, and that was it. They took everything, that BIA. And everybody go, oh, that's just old Joe. You know, but in 2012, the United States, in order to settle Cobell, admitted the BIA stole everything. Every dollar, every penny, for 100 years, they've been sending it out to politicians and local bureaucrats, splitting it, sending a few pennies to the elderly people so that they have proof, oh, she cashed that check. You know, and so he was vindicated. That's 2012, that's in your lifetime. 1990s, we got Eagle Feathers and Peyote back. Peyote is a 10,000-year-old church. Eagle Feather right there. That spirit holds us. See, Fred brought that in as a witness. And I can't lie with that feather here. I can't tell a mistruth. It has to be all factual. Or people look at me and say, oh, you're low status. You cannot be trusted with the truth. So we'll no longer give you the truth. See, in our way, or we give you the words, and you're supposed to carry it and share it. They're not your words to keep. Thank you.
Thank you.